so that the boards sparkle and crack under our boots. A thin veneer of smoke hangs in the air, but it's a sweet tobacco, and welcome relief from the sludgy evening outside. The noise is mostly conversation at a level volume, combined with the soft clatter of cutlery on plates. There's a man with a theorbo sitting at the bar, his feet up as he tunes the strings. "You chose this place?" I ask Monty as I look around. "Your taste has gotten far more civil since I last saw you. No one's got their top off."
"Please don't compliment me on my morals. It makes me feel very obsolete."
He's put on his best coat for the occasion, a coat he apparently could not spare for accompanying me to the hospital, and his face is washed. It's an approximation of looking presentable, though he still looks like less a gentleman and more like the raw ore mined to create one.
"It's just that I can't hear a bloody thing if it's noisier than this."
"There's Scipio."
Percy waves, and I follow his gaze to the familiar crowd in one corner. Monty fumbles for Percy's hand, and I follow them across the room. Privateering suits the crew of the Eleftheria. They are all better dressed and less gaunt than the last time I saw them. Most of them still sport sailors' beards, but their cheeks don't valley beneath them any more. The ranks have shifted. I know Scipio, Ibrahim, and King George, now a whole foot taller, but just as enamoured with Percy as proved by his sprint across the room and tackle hug. But with them are two other dark-skinned men I don't recognise, one with a curled moustache and gold earring, the other with three fingers missing on his left hand. There's a third, much smaller and smooth-faced person, in a shapeless tunic and a headscarf, so hunched over a mug that I can't immediately tell if it's a man or a woman. Scipio claps Monty and Percy warmly on their backs and gives Monty's newly shorn hair an affectionate ruffle before he takes my hand in both of his and kisses it.
"Felicity Montague, what are you doing here? Did you come all the way from Scotland just to see us?"
Before I have a chance to answer, he asks,
"And have you grown taller, or am I shorter than when we last met?"
"She's not. It's those damned boots of hers."
Monty slings himself into the booth beside Ibrahim.
"They've got the thickest soles I've ever seen."
"He's sore. I'm taller than him," I say. Scipio laughs through his nose.
"He lost several inches in cutting that hair."
"Don't."
Monty claps a hand to his heart in reverence. "I'm still in mourning."
"You've got a new crew."
Percy reaches down to shake hands with the two men I don't recognise, then slides into the booth beside Monty, unfolding his long legs under the table while I take the chair across from them.
"We needed more hands sooner than expected,"
Scipio says.
"This is Zaire and Tumalo, picked up from the tobacco trade in Portugal. And that,"
he points down to the slouching youth at the end of the table,
"is Sim, from Algiers, who adopted a legitimate life to join us."
Sim looks up from her beer. Her face is heart-shaped and small, made even more pointed by the frame of her headscarf. Her features seem almost too large for such a small canvas. The two men stand to shake hands around, but she doesn't move.
"How have you found sailing as merchants under the British Crown?" Percy asks, as we all settle into the booth.
Scipio laughs.
"I am of a far calmer temperament than I was when we sailed without patronage. We're still questioned more than most British crews when we're on European soil, but at least we have letters now."
"Where have you been travelling?" I ask.
"Still in the Mediterranean, mostly,"
he replies.
"Portugal and Algiers and Tunis and Alexandria. It's all dead cargo. Your uncles kept us away from the Royal African Company,"
he says to Percy.
"We saw him in Liverpool last month, and he seemed very well."
Percy smiles. Percy's aunt and uncle, though ready to see him committed to an asylum, were far from tyrants. His uncle had been gracious in using his position to aid the crew of the Eleftheria as thanks for the role they'd played in our safety while abroad. In contrast, Monty and I had each written one letter to our father, letting him know only that we were not deceased, but also not coming home, and received nothing in return. While my father had been hostile to Monty and indifferent to me, he was the sort of man who would have cut off his own hand if it meant avoiding scandal, and two children mysteriously disappearing on the same trip to the continent would have all the bees buzzing back in Cheshire.
"Oh, tell Felicity the story about the goats in Tunis," Monty demands, though I'm spared by the distraction of Georgie returning with the beer.
"Have you been corresponding?" I ask Scipio. I know Percy organised this reunion, but not that there has been much more communication between them.
"On occasion,"
Scipio replies.
"Here, Miss Montague, you and Sim may have something in common,"
Ibrahim interrupts and calls down the table.
"Sim, what do you think of London?"
She raises her head. Her face doesn't change, but I can feel the rehearsed nature of this bit, like she has been called upon to do it more than once and is growing tired.
"I hate it." "Why do you hate it?"
he goads.
"Too many white men," she replies.
Ibrahim laughs. Sim doesn't. Across the table, she meets my eyes, and some invisible string seems to tighten between us. Her head cants to the side as she inspects me. It makes me feel like a specimen pinned open on a corkboard for students to study. I'm given an excuse to look away when Scipio says to me,
"How have you taken to the north? Percy said you'd been in Scotland."
"She's already tired of Scotland," Monty answers.
To compensate for his deafness, he's taken to either staring with off-putting intensity at whoever he's speaking to, or turning away so his good ear is toward them. I know it's necessary for his hearing, but the latter makes it look as though he isn't paying attention, magnifying the already dismissive air he's prone to giving off. I shouldn't be annoyed by it, but I'm an easily stoked fire tonight. Monty pokes me in the ribs with his elbow.
"Maybe Scipio will take you to the continent."
When I don't smile, Scipio looks between us.
"Are you travelling again?"
"No, Monty is being cruel," I say.
"I'm not being cruel," he protests. "It was an honest suggestion. You've got no other means to travel."
I glare at him. "And you know Stuttgart is entirely landlocked, don't you?"
"I do now,"
he says into his beer. Across from me, Sim's head snaps up. She has both fists resting on the table, knuckles notched into each other, and her thumbs pressed into a steeple.
"What business is taking you to Stuttgart?"
Ibrahim asks. I let out a heavier sigh than I mean to, and my spectacles fog. "My friend Joanna Hoffman is getting married." It seems the simplest explanation, but leave it to Monty to show off the dirty underside of everything.
"She wants to go to Stuttgart because her friend is marrying a famous doctor Felicity's obsessed with and wants to work for."
"I am not obsessed with Alexander Platt," I snap.
"She's been turned down by every surgeon and hospital in Edinburgh, and she doesn't have any money or way to travel, but she's still ready to go gallivanting off because Dr. Cheeseden told her that this Platt fellow is theoretically, possibly, maybe, hiring a secretary."
Monty looks to Scipio.
"Tell her it's a terrible idea."
I want to kick Monty under the table, but there are so many legs tangled up, I'm afraid I'd misjudge and dig an unwarranted toe into an innocent stander-by. "It is not a terrible idea," I snap, before Scipio can answer him. "And it's Cheselden, not Cheeseden."
"Do you have any opposition to oysters and eggs for supper?"
Scipio calls down the table, interrupting Monty and me before we can properly show our claws.
"Georgie, come help me carry plates."
As soon as they've gone, and Ibrahim has turned down to converse with the other two men, I give my brother a hard stare. I would have tossed that mug of warm beer in his face if I hadn't suspected I'd soon need it, as I am no great lover of oysters. In return, He adopts a wide-eyed innocence.
What's that look for?
I lean in, my tone clipped as a fingernail. First, you don't have to be a smug prick about the fact that I don't have money or means to travel, or that I was barred from the hospital, because in spite of what you and Callum and everyone else seem to want, I am not going to give up and settle down. Second, you are not in control of my actions simply because you are the closest man to me. What I do is not up to you, nor to anyone, particularly someone so ignorant of the difficulties of my current position. And third, Monty, that's my leg. The ascent his foot has been making up my thigh halts. Percy peers under the table, where his legs are stretched out parallel to mine, then pats his own knee.
Is this what you're after?
Monty flops backward into the booth, raising a puff of dust from the upholstery.
You can't be serious about travelling, Fel. It's insane.
No more than giving up your inheritance to live a skillless sod in London, I snap. You're a professional card player, remember. You're not curing cholera.
Stop it, both of you,
Percy interrupts, a hand going up over the table between us like he's refereeing a boxing match.
This is meant to be a nice evening, and you're ruining it.
There's a pause. Then he says to Monty with a frown,
My legs aren't actually thinner than Felicity's, are they?
Oh, stop it, Purse. You know you have magnificent calves, Monty says, then adds, And Felicity has very hairy socks.
Magnificent calves, I scoff. Could you have picked a less erogenous body part? It was an unwise door to open, for Percy pipes up,
Monty has nice shoulders.
Monty pillows his cheeks upon his fist in a swoon.
Do you really think so, darling?
You think he's got deep dimples in his cheeks,
Percy says to me. You should see his shoulders.
Here I thought nothing could inflate my brother's head more. I swear his chest actually puffs up. I'm no great lover of this mealy beer, but I take a drink just for the drama of it before I reply. I pray nightly I never again have occasion to see my brother's bare shoulders.
Come on now.
Monty knocks his foot into mine, then peers beneath the table to make sure he's aimed correctly this time.
If you're going to be a doctor, you mustn't be shy about human anatomy.
It's not human anatomy that makes me queasy, it's your anatomy.
My anatomy is excellent, he replies.
Yes, it is,
Percy adds, pressing his lips to Monty's jawline just below his earlobe. Dear God, stop! I resist the urge to cover my eyes. You're still in public, you know. Monty drags himself away from Percy and gives me a saccharine smile.
Felicity, my darling, you know we love you dearly and are so very delighted that you're staying with us for the time being, but it does place some limitations upon the sort of, shall we say, activities that we are accustomed to engaging in both frequently and privately.
Stop talking now, I interrupt, and go find a back room somewhere and suck each other's faces off. Monty grins, his hands suspiciously out of sight beneath the table.
That's not what I intend to be sucking.
You are the filthiest creature on God's green earth, I tell him. Percy wraps an arm around Monty's shoulder and pulls him into his chest. Their vast height difference is only slightly less comical when they are seated.
Isn't it adorable?
That roguish grin goes wider.
I told you I'm adorable.
They slink off together, though slink is far too sheepish a word for it, as there's absolutely nothing sheepish about it. They strut, hand in hand, and tripping over each other in delight, obnoxiously proud to be in love. Scipio and Georgie return with food, neither of them asking where the gents disappeared to, thank God. I don't eat much, or talk. Scipio asks a few gentle questions about how I'm doing, but my answers must be brisk and simple enough that he knows I'm not in the mood. By the end of the meal, I'm sitting alone at the edge of the group, picking at the cracked white paint on the tabletop and wishing Monty weren't so right. It's mad to go to Stuttgart alone. More than mad, It's impossible. I have almost no money. Certainly not enough to get to the continent. And what would I do once I arrived? What does one say to a friend who broke your heart? Hello, remember me? We were young together, and I used to collect bugs in jars and broke chicken bones from supper so we could practice setting them. But then you called me a pig in a party dress in front of all your new friends, and I said you were shallow and uninteresting. Congratulations on your union. May I talk to your husband about a job? I sink down in my seat without meaning to, one hand sliding into my pocket and fiddling with the edges of my list. Someone sits down at the table across from me, and I look up, expecting Monty and Percy returned from their backroom romp. It's Sim. In spite of the trousers and loose shirt, she's far more feminine-looking in close proximity. The bones of her face are fine and elegant in the lamplight. She doesn't say anything, and I'm not sure what it is she wants from me. We stare at each other for a moment, both of us waiting for the other to speak.
"Am I interrupting your sulking?" she says at last.
"I'm not sulking," I reply, though I very clearly was.
"So your posture is always that terrible?"
Her English has the same accent as Ibrahim's. He was raised speaking Darija in Marrakesh before being kidnapped and sold into slavery in the American colonies. Before I can reply, she presses on,
"You want to go to Stuttgart?"
I throw my hands up, a gesture that nearly overturns my mug. "Good! So everyone overheard that."
"No one overheard it," she says. "We just heard it. Your brother speaks very loudly."
"He's deaf," I say, then add, "and obnoxious." Her face doesn't change.
"I want to take you."
"Take me where?"
"To the continent."
"The continent?"
"To Stuttgart."
She pauses, then says,
"Do you want to repeat that as well?"
Her tone snaps with impatience that I can't keep up, as though she's proposing something as casual as paying a call together. Though I might have been flummoxed even if her choice of conversation had been more conventional, for her eyes are very dark and very intense, and they've got me fumbling for an answer.
"You want to go there,"
she says slowly, tapping a finger on the table between us.
"I want to take you."
"You want to... why?"
"You know Joanna Hoffman, and you're invited to her wedding."
None of that answers my question. I'm also most definitely not invited to the wedding, but a correction would overturn a complicated grave, so I ask, "I'm sorry, who are you?"
"Oh, do we need to make some preliminaries?"
She holds a hand over the table, which I don't take.
"I'm Sim. I work for Scipio."
I almost roll my eyes. "Well, now that the niceties are out of the way..."
"I can do more," she says. "The weather's cold. Ibrahim thinks it's funny to hear me say there are too many white men in London. You should wash your hair more."
"Excuse me?"
"Your braid fell in your beard when you were slouching."
She folds her hands upon the table with a nod, satisfied with the perfunctory chat.
"I'm Sim, your Felicity. I want to take you to Germany."
If she's joking, I can't tell. Her face is impossible to read, those enormous eyes offering no hints. I'm more accustomed to Monty, who can't make a jape without congratulating himself. "Why do you want to take me to Germany?" I ask again. Her boot knocks my shin under the table, and I'm annoyed that it's me who moves to give her room.
"Because I need to go to the Hoffman house, and that will be easier if I have you to help me."
"Why do you need to get to the Hoffmans?"
"It doesn't matter."
"No, actually, that matters quite a lot to me." I sit up straighter and match her folded hands upon the table. "If you're going there to say, as what I hope is an extreme example, murder someone or set the house on fire, I'd rather not be complicit in that. Your introduction from the captain included mention of sailing legitimately, which implies that you once didn't." A flash of irritation breaks over her face, just for a moment, but enough for me to think that this stoic facade may be just that. She's working very hard to appear much cooler and tougher than she actually is, like she hopes that will balance out the fact that she's ripped open and vulnerable in asking me for this.
I'm not murdering anyone.
And yet you're silent about arson.
I'll pay your way. All your expenses to Stuttgart. The Eleftheria's payout was good. I can prove it if you want. All I ask is that you let me pretend to be your maid so that the Hoffmans will put us up in the house. You can do what you like while we're there. Go to the wedding or accost that man you're obsessed with.
I'm not obsessed, and I promise
no one will be in danger or hurt.
She sucks in her cheeks, making a hard, unflattering face. The lamp on the table turns her skin the bright amber of monarch wings.
You can trust me. I'm one of Scipio's crew.
You're a sailor, I say. What does a sailor want with an English family abroad? I'm trying to remember if Joanna's family has any connection to trade or sailing, but by the time her father died and she left England to live with her uncle, we were seeing as little as possible of each other. Sim works her mouth into a hard line, then, with great care, says,
"To reclaim something that was taken from my family."
"So you're a thief?"
"That's not what I said."
"Reclaim is just theft in fancy dress."
"It's not theft," she says. "There is an item that belonged to my family, and I believe it's now in possession of the Hoffmans. All I want is a location."
"The Hoffmans are an upstanding family," I say. "Joanna's father was an aristocrat, and her uncle's a businessman. What sort of dealings would they have with..." I trail off, but Sim finishes for me.
"With someone like me?"
"With common sailors," I say. "What's this mysterious item of unknown location? Is it treasure?" She stares down at the table, digging her thumb into a chip of white paint until it snaps free.
"More like a birthright."
"That's a very abstract concept to be stealing."
"All right. You're not interested. I'm finished."
She stands up to go, but almost before I realize I've spoken, the word, "Wait!" tumbles from me. She pauses, her chin to her shoulder, so that her headscarf obscures most of her face. This is a bad idea, and I know it. Humans have instincts specifically for situations like this. Everything in me is saying there is danger lurking in this forest, eyes bright and hungry through the dark. I want to walk in anyway. Because it's Alexander Platt. It's medical schooling. It's a chance to plant my feet firmly in a direction away from Callum and wifedom and general gentility. What does it matter to me what clandestine mission is drawing her to the same house as me? She's just a bank with credit to travel. I'm doing nothing wrong so long as she doesn't. "If we go," I say, "you are there only for a location. You have to promise me there won't be a theft or damage or harm done to any person or item. I won't let you into their house just to make a robbery of it. That's my condition."
"I said I wouldn't steal anything."
"Promise me."
"Why are you so certain I'm villainous?"
"Because the alternative is that you're simply doing a good turn for a stranger, and your initial approach would lead me to believe otherwise." I have suppressed enough eye rolls in my lifetime to know she's working very hard to do so.
"I promise."
"We have to leave soon," I tell her. "The wedding is in 3 weeks." Even as I say it, it hardly feels like enough time, particularly if we're travelling on limited funds. There's a chance we'll arrive only to find Dr. Platt and Joanna have already traded their vows and are now cozied up in some honeymoon suite leagues away. Arriving uninvited to a wedding is one thing, bursting in on a honeymoon quite another.
"I'm ready to leave whenever you are,"
she replies. "Will you be missed?" She shakes her head. "And you won't tell my brother?"
"Does that mean you're in?"
She holds out a hand again, and this time I take it. I expect a firm shake, but instead she pulls me up so that we're nose to nose. She's a few inches taller than I am, thin but powerful. Perhaps those hungry eyes are hers. Perhaps I don't care. Yes, I say, and it feels like a step off a cliff. My pulse flutters with the freefall. I'm in. 6. I wait until the next morning to tell Monty I'm leaving. I hoped to catch both him and Percy at the same time so that Percy could provide a buffer between my brother and me, but he departed early for a concert, and Monty woke late from a night at his casino, so he has his breakfast while I take luncheon, though they're both comprised of the same stale bread and coffee. He receives the news with indifference, most likely because all I say is that I'm leaving, with no additional details about where or with whom that departure will be made. From his perch upon the stove, rippling the surface of his steaming coffee with his breath, Monty asks,
"So what are you going to say to Mr. Doyle? Should I be checking the post for a wedding invitation?"
I drop a cube of bread into my coffee to soften it. "Actually, I'm not going to Edinburgh. I'm going to Joanna's wedding."
"What?"
He looks up.
"How?"
"That's not important."
"I think that's rather critical information."
I fish the bread out of my cup with my spoon. I can feel him staring at me, but I refuse to look. "The woman we had supper with, from Scipio's crew. She's helping me."
"Why?"
"Because I want to go to Stuttgart."
"That's not what I meant. Why is she helping you?"
He may not be the sharpest scalpel in the surgical kit, but he'll raise the concerns I have forced myself to ignore at the mention of reclaiming a birthright. So instead, I offer up a question in deflection. "Why are you making that face at me?"
"You're going to meet that doctor, aren't you?"
"I am going because Joanna is my friend, and I'd like to see her married," I say. Monty snorts.
"Is she? I seem to remember you two shouting at each other at Caroline Peel's birthday party, and you making a very impassioned decree that you had no further interest in her company."
I set my mug on the stack of trunks that serves as their table, a little harder than I mean to. A few drops slosh out over my hand.
"Why are you being such an ass about this?" "Because this sounds like a terrible idea, and I'm worried about you."
"Well, that's not reason enough for me not to go," I say. "I worry constantly about you and Percy being pilloried or tossed in the Marshalsea or you setting your flat on fire because you don't know how to boil water, but I don't stop you."
"I'm not trying to stop you from studying medicine, but I'm not going to pretend I think this is the way to do it."
"What other way is there?" I ask. I'm annoyed that my tone is rising while his is staying maddeningly even. I am not usually the first of us to grow agitated.
"I may not get another chance like this." "But you're smart, and you work hard, and you don't give up. It's not a matter of if, it's when."
He's not going to understand. It crystallizes for me in a moment. We may have grown up in the same house, two restless children with contrary hearts, but our parents sought to sand down our edges in different ways. Monty suffered under the hand of a father who paid far too much attention to his son's every movement, while mine was a youth of neglect, unacknowledged, unimportant. While Monty might have someday run the estate, the best that could be hoped for me was I'd leave it in the arms of a wealthy man. Had he stayed, Monty would have been that wealthy man to some other girl. That was the best either of us could hope for. We may have both left home, defied our parents and our upbringings in favour of our passions, but there are rocks in my road Monty can't understand how to navigate, or even conceive of being there in the first place. He drains his coffee, wipes his mouth on his sleeve, then says,
"Stay a few more weeks with us, or we can find you a room somewhere and help you with the rent. Write to your Dr. Platt and see what he says.
visit a few more of the hospitals here. He bites his lip, and I know I won't like what he says next.
Just don't go to Stuttgart with that woman, all right? It's a bad idea.
He's not going to understand. Better to pretend that I do.
Fine, I say.
He looks up, and I wonder if my tone was curt enough to raise suspicion. I had tried to sound sincere, but had fallen rather short.
Really?
He says.
You agree with me?
Of course I do. It's far more sensible to stay in London.
Yes!
He slaps a hand upon his knee.
Exactly, yes! Remember this day, Felicity. The day you agreed, I am the more sensible out of the pair of us.
I'll mark it in my diary, I say dryly, then stand up to refill my mug. Hopefully, the movement will disrupt the conversation enough that he'll truly think me a changed woman, and we can move forward to something else. I shall not get Monty's permission to go to Stuttgart. Luckily, I don't need it. I continue the charade of planning to stay in London for the next 2 days before Sim and I are to depart. I let Percy suggest neighbourhoods in which I might look for a flat, and Monty make ludicrous propositions about how I shall break into the field of medicine, all the while gathering my meagre possessions in my knapsack under the pretense of tidying up the flat. It is a traditionally feminine enough activity that neither Monty nor Percy seems suspicious. Then, in the wee hours of the last day of the week, I get up after a sleepless night, dress silently in the dark, and let myself out of the flat, my knapsack knocking against the backs of my knees. It will be 2 weeks of travel to Stuttgart, then the wedding festivities, provided we manage to weasel our way into the household. If the position with Dr. Platt comes to fruition, I don't intend to return to Moorfields, particularly not as a dependent house guest. Neither do I intend to return to Edinburgh. On my way to the harbour, I drop a 3-line missive at the post office to Callum, saying that I will be staying in London longer than planned, as my brother's syphilis/boredom is more serious than anticipated, leaving out any mention of the fact that I am going to the continent with a stranger to make a future for myself that will not include him. I have challenged fate to chess, and am now attempting to keep all my confidence from puddling in my boots. What if I'm the only one betting on myself, because everyone but me can see I am not suited to play at all? You are Felicity Montague, I say to myself, and touch the paper in my pocket listing my arguments, which, if all goes according to this impossible plan, will now be made in some variation before Alexander Platt. Dr. Cheselden's card is nestled in its folds. You have stowed aboard a ship and travelled 48 days with a single outfit. You are not a fool. You're a fighter, and you deserve to be here. You deserve to take up space in this world. The harbours are perhaps the vilest part of a vile city. The ground is slick with a foul combination of fish intestines, yellow spittle, gull droppings, vomit, and other fluids I'd rather not give too much thought to. Even at this early hour, the narrow docks are packed, every person certain their business is most important, and therefore that snapping at others to get out of their way is justified. The wind off the water picks up a spray from the fetid Thames and spews it in my face as I search the crowd for Sim. I find her lingering near the end of the queue of passengers waiting to board the packet, and when she sees me coming, she steps into the line in earnest. She's swapped her sailing duds for a muslin dress and unembroidered shawl tucked into the stomacher, topped with a heavy wool cloak. When I join her, she forgoes a greeting and instead says, "You look upset." "And your scarf has a hole in it," I snap. "Oh, look, we're all making observations." She doesn't reply, and perhaps I imagine her shifting her weight so she's facing away from me. But I press my hands to my face and give my head a good shake to clear it. I'm sorry. I'm anxious, that's all.
About leaving?
No, more about the fact that... It seems unwise to tell her that no one knows where I am, so instead I say, my brother's an ass, that's all.
So are mine.
Your what?
My brothers. They're all asses.
Brothers, plural? Had I been forced to grow up in a household of multiple Montys, I would have got myself to a nunnery just for some quiet. How many have you got?
Four.
Four? I nearly swoon. Older or younger?
All younger.
She grimaces.
All very loud.
Are they sailors too? She nods, adjusting her grip on her bag.
Or they will be. The littlest one is only 8, but he'll be at sea soon. All my family are sailors.
What sort of sailors? I ask. But Sim is already turned away from me, instead peering ahead to the front of the queue where boarding cards are being checked before we're allowed on the deck. And though I know she's heard me, she doesn't answer. That's fine, I say. I'm more annoyed at her silence than I likely should be, but in my defence, it has been an exceedingly stressful few weeks, and all my emotions seem to be operating at a higher level than usual. We needn't exchange any personal information. We'll only be together constantly for the next several weeks. I'd rather remain strangers in proximity. I push myself up on my toes, trying to see over the heads of the other passengers. This is taking too long.
Maybe you're impatient,
Sim says, still aggravatingly calm. I am not impatient. I just know how long things should take. She blows into her hands.
Then maybe you're opinionated.
Well, my opinion is that you shouldn't pass judgments upon me. I cross my arms, turning away from her and the line to instead look around the harbour. The sails of the moored ships flutter in the wind, smaller boats flitting between them with punters digging their poles into the bottom of the Thames. The ropes of a sledge crane nearby have snapped, and a merchant in a fine suit speckled with salt is shouting at a group of boys about the damage to his goods. Several planks down from us, there's a mess of raw fish spilled and trampled into the boards. A porter slips on the guts and drops the trunk he's carrying, grabbing onto a stranger beside him for balance, a stranger in a ridiculous hat. It's Monty. Oh, no! Sim looks up from her hands.
What?
I pivot sharply, my back to Monty, though that will hardly be a hiding place for long. My brother's here.
Is that a problem?
I didn't tell him I was leaving. I mean, I did, but he wasn't thrilled about that. So I lied and said I wasn't, but in the process gave him just enough details that if I was to disappear in the middle of the night, he'd know where I was going.
And you disappeared in the middle of the night?
Not the middle of the night, I protest. The very early hours of the morning. Sim must spot Monty as well, for she ducks down at my side.
He's coming this way.
Of course he's coming this way. We're standing in line for the ferry to Calais, the first place to seek out your sister fleeing to the continent. Come on! I pull Sim out of the line, up the dock, and then out of sight behind the cargo dropped by the crane. I turn to her, my knapsack knocking me hard in the small of the back. What do we do?
I don't know. He's your brother, she replies.
He's also a human man, which I assume you've had dealings with in the past. I press my face into the collar of my cloak, trying to examine the situation as though it were far more scientific than it is. The problem, avoiding Monty, who is paying careful attention to everyone boarding the ship to Calais. The resources at our disposal? Little to nothing. Sim, me, my knapsack, which is mostly mittens and books and underthings, though I suppose throwing a book at his face and then running aboard would not be a bad distraction. That or just shout something about menstruation and watch the entire dock erupt into chaos. It worked so effectively with the hospital board. We do not have time to wait for another ship. The sky is clear today, and winter weather is an unpredictable horse to bet on. Tomorrow might be stormy, the channel so chopped up that no ships can break through it. The wind may be too strong, the air too cold, the water too treacherous with chunks of ice. Our window to get to Stuttgart is so narrow, there's a chance we might miss the wedding even with everything running on time. We have to be on that boat, whether Monty is in the way or not. We have to distract him, I say. He hasn't got a boarding card, so he can't follow us onto the boat, so we only need occupy him long enough to make a run for it, and probably wait for the queue to die down. We'll have the best chance right as they're about to cast off.
How are you going to distract him without him seeing you?
Sim asks. We get someone else, I say, trying to sound more confident and not like I'm making this up on the spot. We pay someone.
We can't afford to pay someone.
How much money do you have, exactly?
She screws up her lips, then says very carefully,
enough to get us to Stuttgart.
Brilliant, I grumble.
If you want to pay someone to go punch your brother in the face, that can be your share for dinner tonight.
I don't want someone to punch him, I protest, then add, I mean, I do, but not right now. But we need some kind of distraction.
Had I more time to think this through, I could certainly come up with a more elegant plan. But time is not on our side. I set out from behind our hiding place, Sim chasing me down with a yelp of surprise at my sudden movement. Away from the water and the ships, the dock is teeming with sailors and deckhands, some of them working, some of them huddled around smoking braziers, warming their hands over the flames. There's a bakery window selling cakes and mulled wine, the kind where you help yourself and drop some coins into the box on your honour. Having more crisis than honour, I take a mug without paying and start toward one of the clusters of men. But Sim stops me.
Tell me what you're doing.
Asking a man to distract my brother long enough that we can board the boat. I expect she'll argue. Not only is it vague, but most of my plans are talked back to by participating parties. But she just nods, then scans the group of sailors closest to us. You think that will work? I ask, my voice peaking on the last word. I am unaccustomed to being trusted so absolutely, and Sim is not someone I had expected to offer up that trust easily.
It will certainly do something. Ask that one.
She points to a man huddled alone against the wall of a dock office. I can smell from here that he's in his altitudes, or perhaps coming down off a binge the night before. His skin is withered from the sun. The strips poking out of the two short sleeves of his coat are covered in blue ink. Several other drawings crawl up from his collar and along the back of his neck. He does not look like the sort of man I want to trust my escape to. But Sim put her faith in me. The least I can do is the same. I stride up to the gentleman, careful not to spill my mug of hot wine. He looks up from his pipe as we approach, regarding us with a squint, though the sun has hardly risen. "Good morning, sir," I say. "I would like to offer you this drink."
"All right, then."
He's reaching for it before I've finished my sentence, and I have to snatch it away, nearly dumping it all over Sim. "Wait, first you must do something for me."
"Don't want to do anything for you,"
he replies, tucking back into his pipe packing. "It's very simple," I say. "Do you see that man over there, standing by the dredge? He's short and has his hair cut, scars on his face." The sailor glances up.
"The one with the adorable hat?"
"Damn it, Monty. Now I wish our distraction was punching him in the face. That one exactly. I need you to go over to him and pour this drink down his front. But make it seem like an accident, and then take a good long time telling him you're sorry and helping him clean up."
"Then I don't get the drink," the man says slowly.
"Well spotted," I reply. "But you don't have to pour all of it." He stares at us, his head weaving, though I can't tell if that's because he's actually considering the offer or about to tip over. Then he hawks a ball of spit at the boards and sticks his pipe in his mouth.
No thanks.
I'm ready to move on and try another dafter sailor, but Sim steps forward.
Come here, she says,
crooking a finger at him.
I want to tell you something.
The man runs his tongue around his mouth, eyes flashing as he leans in. Sim grabs him by the collar and yanks him to her, a long black knife drawn from her boot and pressed against the soft meat of his throat. It is, if the throat is to be slit, not technically the best place to approach from. She'd have better luck going in from the side, stabbing into the carotid artery, then moving forward and down to the vocal cords to ensure silence and letting out both major blood supplies to the brain simultaneously. But I'm less concerned about that and far more concerned by the fact that first, Sim has a knife in her boot that she brought along with her for unknown but likely unsavory reasons, and second, she is about to use that knife to slit a man's throat. The sailor gurgles with fear, his eyes bulging in his head. Sim tosses back her sleeve, and I watch the man's eyes travel from her knife to her forearm, and somehow he looks even more afraid.
You see this, she says to him, and he nods.
You sail under the bleeding crown and cleaver, he says, his voice higher than a moment before.
Sim presses the knife harder, though not enough to draw blood. The man lets out a whimper.
You know what that means, do you?
She looks pointedly at the ink on his neck, and he doesn't nod this time. The knife is pressed in too deep to risk any sudden movements.
You do as she says, Sim says,
then shoves him into the wall. She replaces the knife in her boot, then straightens and nods me toward him. I don't know if she's expecting me to acknowledge my gratitude for her help, but my throat has gone dry. The instinct to step back from her, to pull away and run and unknot myself from our alliance, rises inside me, primal and animal, the compass of my heart pointing straight to flee. That knife and that threat has confirmed the very likely truth that I have avoided looking in the eyes since Sim dropped her proposition upon me at the Minced Nancy. I am likely taking up with a dangerous person who might hurt me or the people to whom I'm exposing her. If someone in the House Hoffman is to have their throat cut in their bed, she might take me as well, just to ensure my silence. Below us, the sailor asks, Can I have the drink? I take a deep breath and turn to him, trying to look less shaken than I am. You may hold it, but you may not drink it, and do not move until I signal you. A harbour bell begins to toll the hour, and one of the sailors on board our ship shouts down to the man on the dock checking the manifest. Signal, I say, yanking our man to his feet and shoving him forward. Go make yourself a nuisance. Sim and I watch together as he makes a halting stagger through the crowd, tracking his progress with our own path along the dock and back toward the ship, ducking behind every crate and cart and barrel that will hide us. The gent moves much slower than I had hoped he would move. The harbour bells are finishing, and the sailors about our packet are pulling in the gangplank, and Monty is starting toward the man at the end of it, like he might ask after the names on the manifest to see if I'm listed there. Our drunken friend veers sharply, raises his glass in the most theatrical of gestures, and pours it over a complete stranger, which certainly causes a commotion, though among the wrong people. I curse under my breath, ready to just run for the ship, but Sim grabs my arm. I flinch without meaning to, still thinking of that knife, but she's only directing my eyes. The commotion is close enough to Monty that he has to dodge out of the way to avoid the ruckus, and he glances over at our sailor, right as the sailor realizes his error and looks back at us as if we might be holding some kind of sign with printed directions of what to do now. Monty follows his gaze, and across the harbour our eyes lock. My stomach drops. He starts toward me, and I'm ready to run, but then our sailor, clearly afraid of Sim's wrath should he fail, throws himself at Monty and tackles him. The sailor is a fair bit bigger than my brother, and the force of the hit knocks him more sideways than I imagine was intended, because both Monty and the sailor plummet over the edge of the pier and into the rancid, freezing Thames.
"That works,"
Sim says, and I feel her hand on my back, pushing me forward.
"Go, now!"
I almost don't, partly because there is a chance real harm has been done to my brother, exactly the thing I had hoped to avoid with drink-pouring rather than face-punching as a distraction, and more than partly because of Sim's bright icicle of a knife and the fear in the man's eyes when he recognized her. "If you're going to run, this is the time. Do it before you leave London, before you're far enough from home that you'd never get back on your own." I glance down the dock to where a few kind souls are fishing my brother and our sailor out of the river. They both look unharmed, no visible blood or limbs pointing the wrong direction. They're sopping wet and shivering, but Monty will be a bloodhound after my scent as soon as his feet are on dry land again. "Last chance," I think, staring forward up the gangplank. "Last chance to run, to change your mind, to find another fight, or surrender altogether and trade in whatever danger undoubtedly lies ahead for a cozy bake shop and a kind baker back in Edinburgh. But I'm not giving up on a spot with Alexander Platt. If I'm going to place a bet, it's going to be on me and my ability to outfox and outrun Sim, should the need arise. You are Felicity Montague, I tell myself, and you are not afraid of anything. And when Sim sprints down the dock and up the gangplank of the packet, I follow her. It's a day on the water to Calais. If the sky stays clear and the channel cooperative, we'll be in France by sunset. We don't take a cabin, and below deck is frigid and wet and smells foul. So we sit upon the benches lined against the rails, where the air is cold but fresh. The hood of my cloak refuses to stay up, and the wind has its way with my hair, twisting and whirling it out of its pins and into thick clumps that I try to untangle with my fingers, even though I know it's pointless. At my side, Sim watches me struggle with a snarl at the back of my head, her own hands clamped over her headscarf to keep it in place.
"Do you want help?"
she asks. "I'm fine," I say, then give a hard pull that pricks all the way to my eyes. The knot remains maddeningly knotted.
"You're going to rip your hair out of your scalp."
I think I almost have it.
"You don't. Here, stop."
She stands up, brushing her hands off on her skirt before climbing over the bench so she's behind me.
"Let me."
I don't like this. I don't like turning my back to her, letting her put her hands in my hair, her wrist brushing my neck. I'm thinking of that knife against the sailor's throat and how easily it could be against mine at any moment, but especially this moment, with my eyes forward and my skin exposed. She's gentler than I expected. As soon as I think it, I feel guilty for imagining her to be rough and tug at my scalp. I can feel her hands combing through my ends, working with careful precision like it's surgical thread she's untangling.
"I think I'll have to cut it out."
"What?" I spring to my feet and whip around to face her. Her hands are still in my hair, and I feel the sharp pull of leaping without warning, my nerves searing.
"It's just a bit of hair," she says. "You won't even notice."
I reach back and touch the knot to make certain she isn't bluffing. I can feel the impossible snarl. "With your knife," I blurt before I can stop myself.
"My... oh."
She reaches down into her boot, slowly, and with her eyes on me, like she wants to be certain I don't spook.
"It's not a knife. It's a marlin spike."
She holds it up for my inspection, and it is, indeed, not a knife in the most traditional sense. It's a long, tapering spike with a chiseled end, made from black iron and rough along its edges.
It's a sailor's tool, she explains, for sailing ropes.
It hardly matters what it was called. Confidence is half of any bluff, and she had wielded it with the sureness and threat of a blade. You still could have killed that man in the harbour with it, I say. She looks sideways at me. I lift my chin. I want her to know that I know she's dangerous and I'm here anyway. I want her to think me braver than I am, and just as dangerous as her.
Could I? She says.
I'm not sure if she's asking sincerely or if she's testing me. I'm also not sure I should tell her. Had you pressed it down and hooked it below the clavicle bone, just here, I tap my own over my cloak, it would have gone into his lungs, perhaps his heart if you had the angle right. A punctured lung might not have killed him straight away, but he didn't seem like the sort who'd go running for a doctor, so it would have likely been a long, drawn-out death with a lot of wheezing and shortness of breath, and then there would still be the blood, and he could easily lose enough to prove fatal. Why are you looking at me like that?
How do you know all of that? She asks.
I read a lot of books.
By that man, the one we're going to see.
Among others. She rolls the marlin spike between her hands, the patches rubbed silver by her fingers glinting.
You want to be a surgeon?
A physician, actually. It's a different license and requires more... It doesn't matter. I sit down again and turn my back to her, tossing my hair over my shoulder, though the wind immediately yanks it back across my face. Go on, then. Behind me, she lets out a small, breathy laugh.
So spirited.
I'm not spirited, I say, sharper than I mean to. Her hand, which I had felt hovering near my neck, jerks away at the spark in my voice.
All right, easy. I didn't mean it as an insult.
I cross my arms, letting myself sink into a slouch. No one calls a girl spirited or opinionated or intimidating or any of those words you can pretend are complimentary and means it to be. They're all just different ways of calling her a bitch. Her fingers tug at the ends of my hair.
You've heard those words a lot, have you?
Girls like me do. It's a shorthand for telling them they're undesirable.
Girls like you.
She laughs outright this time.
And here I thought the spectacles were decorative.
I twist around to face her. What's that supposed to mean?
The only girls who talk like that are the ones who assume there are no other women like them in the world.
I'm not saying I'm a rare breed, I reply. I just mean, you don't meet many girls like me.
Maybe not, Sim replies, fingering the marlin spike again. Or maybe you just don't look for them.
I turn back around with more of a petulant huff than I intend. Just unknot my hair. There's a pause. Then I feel her fingers against my neck, sweeping my hair over my shoulder so that she's holding the knot on its own.
You're right, she says softly.
Right about what?
I've never met a woman quite like you.
There's a sharp pinch and a sound like ripping cloth, and then she touches my shoulder.
Here.
I hold out my hand, and she drops the knot into it.
No blood spilt.
Thank you. I run my fingers through my hair, trying to find the shorter strands. I should wrap my hair like yours. It would be more practical.
I'm a Muslim, she says. That's why I wear it, not because it's practical.
Oh! I feel silly for not realizing it, then wonder if I am permitted to ask any questions on the subject, or whether that will only prove how ignorant I am on almost all matters of religion, particularly those outside of Europe. I've heard Muslims pray quite a lot. Do you need... I trail off with a shrug. When she goes on looking at me, I finish, somewhere private, or incense or something. She picks a few stray hairs off the end of her marlin spike, then holds them on her open palm for the wind to snatch.
Have you met a Muslim before?
Ibrahim is as well, isn't he? I say. From the Eleftheria.
Most of their crew is, she says. Or were born into it. Not the Portuguese men, but the lads from the Barbary Coast.
The Barbary Coast pricks a vein inside my mind. I am not